Good Friday afternoon. You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1, homeland of the Métis and the historical territory of the Anishinaabe, Nihiyawak, and the Nakota. My name is Michael Welch. The year 2019 marks the 20th anniversary of your campus community radio station's presence on the FM airwaves, and to mark the occasion, we've been airing vintage spoken word programming that has been produced out of this station for the past two decades. This week, we're specifically airing the unique programming, interviews, and content produced by one programmer in particular. As mentioned in a previous program, Jeffrey Young served in the CKUW News Department right from the time of its very creation. Jeffrey would contribute a multitude of original interviews and craft unique, hard-hitting stories addressing local issues, but particularly international issues. Jeffrey took over as news director from Sarah Michelson roughly 2 years after the role was created. He would serve in that position longer than anyone else at the station ever has. Jeffrey would host a couple of programs. In addition to The Beat and People of Interest, he would broadcast the international news program Radio Free World every Friday in the same 1 p.m. time slot. He also hosted the brilliantly eclectic overnight show, Nine Villages. I recently connected with Jeffrey to get some more insights into his journalistic approach and his time at CKUW. We'll play some of what Jeffrey had to say in just a few minutes, but we'll begin with excerpts from a report he put together on a local popular mobilization against the U.S. Coalition of the Willing's War on Iraq in March of 2003.
Well, in 1991, when there was a war, we didn't stay in the buildings. We went to my grandparents' place because they had a big house, and we had to hide in a place where there's not any windows or anything. So if it gets crashed, we don't get hurt. So we go in the middle of the house, and all my uncles, all my aunties, it's like about 10 or 15 family all together there, you know, praying, crying every time the bombing starts. So I can imagine that they're doing the same thing right now, and it's really sad. We lost contact with our family like a week ago, and that's where all the worries came from.
That was Shahiro Hakim, an Iraqi-Canadian student of University of Winnipeg. I also had a chance to speak to CKUW's own Patrick McGuire.
And where are you out here today?
I'm just out here with hundreds of other people, just, you know, in opposition to the war. I think it's really, really crucial that, you know, it was declared last night, and that, you know, we just got to stand up and come out, you know, at any opportunity.
And what were your thoughts last night when you heard that it had kicked off?
I mean, there's been all this talk about the inevitability of the war and the inevitability of the war. And even on my program yesterday, I talked a little bit about the ultimatum that Bush gave. And the ultimatum was a lie. I mean, there has been, you know, there had been planning, there had been amassing of troops for so long that it was a fait accompli. It was all pomp and circumstance and a show. You know, Bush has every intention of taking over Iraq with or without Saddam.
And that was Patrick McGuire on Thursday night's rally. Later that night, the president's shock and awe phase began as swaths of Baghdad were flattened by waves of bombs and cruise missiles. While U.S. media claimed injuries in the hundreds, many human rights groups and journalists believe that Iraq has suffered deaths in the thousands. BBC reported Saturday night on how flimsy-built shacks were flattened, hardly the military targets the U.S. claimed. On Friday, over 2,000 students came out in what was the most effective and worthwhile protest this weekend in Winnipeg. It was a rousing, energetic affair which culminated in the students marching through the streets despite flaccid threats from the police that anyone who stepped off the sidewalk would be arrested. At the rally, I spoke with some of the participants.
Hi, I'm Tim, and I'm a supporter of the World People's Resistance Movement. This has definitely surpassed our expectations. It's amazing. There's lots of energy and lots of a creative resistance going on. People are in a really good mood here, but there's one thing for sure. They're not happy with George Bush and just recently announced the Shock and Awe campaign. Right now, there's hundreds and thousands are dying.
One of the comments I kept getting from person after person was about their horrific, slanted, unprofessional coverage of the war in the corporate media. One local station that was repeatedly trashed is local CJOB. I tuned in overnight to listen a little. In this time, CJOB airs programming from Clear Channel, the world's biggest radio monopoly. What I heard was some of the most Hitler-esque propaganda imaginable. The show was coast-to-coast AM with Barbara Simpson, And it was a slew of brain-dead, anti-public slander with nary a believable source. It began with the following comments on anti-war protesters.
I appreciate that. I think it's kind of hard, though. Now, I know you had some pretty tough demonstrations there in Chicago. Certainly they did in New York and other cities. It's hard to have respect for people who claim to be peace activists and who are opposed to a war because they want peace, who uses their techniques defecating on the street and throwing up. I find it really hard to have respect for people who do that. They just want to make headlines. They want to go in your face. They're not peace activists. They're pretending. And they're trying to get away with it under that guise. And I think that's most unfortunate.
Oddly enough, the only headline I could find about bodily functions was her very show last night. Now, I've read literally hundreds of accounts of protests all over the world on Saturday, and I have no idea where that came from. I tried for 8 hours today to verify the story, but could not find any sources. Now, on top of that, there was this story.
Oh, and I got actually a very interesting call today on my San Francisco program from a man who said, and he had a very thick accent, so, unless he's a good actor, but I believe him because he was very sincere in his tone of voice, an older man who's been in this country many years, who was praising this country. He's from Iraq, and he told me about his knowledge of the fact that a few years ago, Saddam Hussein used trucks, and he told me the number of trucks, and he told me where they went into Iran, trucks loaded with chemicals and biologicals to get them out of his country so that, for example, the inspectors wouldn't find them. And he said they still have some in the country, which we hopefully will find so that we can back up what our allegations were.
Now, the problems with this part are endless. First, the source is anonymous. Barbara Simpson asserts that the source is believable because of the thick accent and sincere tone. Despite this, she gives no indication of who the source is. Second, the caller claims that Saddam shipped weapons of mass destruction into Iran. This is preposterous, as less than 20 years ago, Saddam had used weapons of mass destruction against Iran with help from the US. It is not conceivable that Saddam would use the weapons and then give them to the country he used them on. Third, the anonymous source asserts, as does the host, that Iraq does have weapons of mass destruction. If this was so, why did the guy not tell the United Nations or the United States intelligence so that the weapons could be found by inspectors? The host wants us to believe that this Iraqi American would prefer to wait quietly until his homeland was attacked. With shoddy journalism such as this, it's a good thing that the peace movement is strong, otherwise no actual information would get out. For CKUW, my name is Jeffrey Young.
Smoke behind the church, little fascist jerks, remind me of our common cause.
I'm Sarah Michelson, former and original news director of CKUW, 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Jeffrey Young was at that first ever team meeting in the cafeteria that day, and he is my inspiration for real-life gonzo journalism, and has been known to travel the world, just sort of disappearing into an Amazon is essentially what he is very good at, and then coming out with wild truth. It's fascinating. And also a very not giving a crap kind of attitude. I really like him a lot.
I wonder though, if, I mean, he's one of a kind, but I wonder if like it was ever any issues of trying to rein him in at times when you were...
No.
Wound him up and let him go?
Yes, very much so.
You provided dissident perspectives on the war on terrorism, the Iraq war, certainly Haiti, and New Orleans after the Hurricane Katrina. Do you recall any significant pushback from listeners or higher-ups? And how supportive was the station?
No. No, there were never any really nothing I would consider a problem. There was some like, but I a couple times butted heads against some of more dogmatic segments of a volunteer base, but there was never, I was always free to do what I want and supported and even encouraged to cause problems, you know, within reason, right? Like not stupid Jews control the world problems, but, you know, things are accentuate things that within the community that needed discussion.
Mm-hmm. Such as?
I mean, I got a question for you, Michael.
Yep.
Have any of those things actually been discussed? Like, do the First Nations folk have a better life in Winnipeg than 10 years ago? Is it more inclusive? Are some of those attitudes starting to drop, or is it still the same donut?
Well, that's a very good question, and you might have some insights from, you know, maybe what, you know, consuming the media. That I think there's a sense that we hear a lot more in terms of like use of the term reconciliation, for instance.
That's true too. There's this kind of responsiveness in culture that we're not going to have.
But that's
everything.
Yeah, that same kind of energy, it's still there. It just seems to express itself in different forms. And I mean, I think that, I mean, whether you want to call it hypocrisy, whether you want to call it cognitive dissonance, we still seem to be ailing from some of the same issues. I mean, the
cognitive dissonance is a good diplomatic.
A diplomatic, yeah, for sure.
And not like the British, not like an English diplomat in America, but like an actually diplomatic.
Yeah, so like, for, you know, case in point, like the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, and we did some coverage on that. Actually, we got a community radio award for it. But I mean, talk about some of the issues. It's that stuff that's, you know, really all symbolic and everything. But when you look at all the resources that go into it, even to the construction of the museum itself, and how it was not very respectful of the indigenous.
That's one part I think I was glad I missed. I had nothing constructive to add to that, to the Human Rights Museum conversation. Mm-hmm. But you're going to be glad you're there for the front row when Marvin the Martian decides to stand up. Because, yeah, so I don't know. It was well underway. The conversation was well underway when I left, but I didn't. I don't know, and like, not to sound jaded, but kind of given what it was and where the backing was coming from, that XYZ wouldn't necessarily be addressed the way we hoped it would. But at the same time, I understand there's aspects of it that are terrific and rather important. I know they took a big chunk of the Sex Professionals of Canada archives and are keeping them.
Oh, interesting.
Or a chunk. Sorry, not a big chunk. I don't know how big a chunk. Probably a box or two.
Yeah. You've been frequently described as your approach to journalism. It was what they call gonzo. Now I know your background. You had a journalism. You took journalism at Ryerson, and you had a lot of experience. Before coming to CKUW, but that gonzo approach has really made a mark, and it's really, I think it's impacted a lot of people here, even though this is something that traditional journalists kind of frown on. You know, you don't be part of the story and whatnot. Could you talk about, in your experience, some of the advantages you've seen with that approach, the unique and distinct stories which become visible when you depart from those typical journalistic norms, the way you did?
I like Hunter Thompson. Hunter S. Thompson, I liked him very much. I was a follower. I thought he was a good writer and a kind of a way of showing directly what it is that he wants to show. So I'm okay with that. But I hope that I grew it up and applied it maybe a little bit differently. And also, I speak for Liam and Liam alone, who was a CKUW volunteer. I think some of the youngins have more balls than Hunter Thompson ever did. That was certainly an influence. But like anybody, you know, like what you do is a collection of cultural touchstones and ideas that work for you is what you pull out. So there's some There's some the residents in there. There's definitely some situationism in there, and there's some Hunter Thompson in there. And it's just kind of an amalgam of my raising, which if not in the parental sense, was largely done by Brave New Waves Radio on CBC.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think everybody at CKUW is my age, pretty much.
Well, we're joined now by Kent Davies. He's been involved with probably a number of different programming, spoken word, music. You've been involved in production. You've been on the staff. You've been on the board. You've probably done everything radio related that's worth doing, and maybe a couple of things not worth doing.
Yeah, I hope so.
Talk a little bit more about your working with Jeffrey Young and some of the stuff that he put out there. He was certainly a notable presence.
Yeah, well, he was also in that IDS, International Development Studies camp as well. We created an impromptu aid organization, but 2008 happened, Hurricane Katrina happened, and he was adamant that something needed to be done down there. There was a quest from the South for, like, the United States for tech support people. And Jeffrey happens to know this guy that he's not the best people person, but he's technologically proficient that if you need to set up a wireless system in a matter of hours, he could probably pull it off with, you know, he was just this genius MacGyver guy.
Yeah.
So they got the green light to go down there, and there's a whole book written about all our escapades of that. But I was basically, I was running the news team. He went to do that. But he was also working while he was there because he was interviewing all these sorts of people and explaining, you know, this, like, and I believe, I don't know if it had happened yet, but Naomi Klein was going to release Shock Doctrine. And this was a test case scenario for Shock Doctrine. This is That's what right. was happening. So, you know, in a nutshell, so the Ninth Ward flooded, right? That land was super valuable, but it wasn't at the time when they gave it to the descendants of slaves, which was, you know, that was your 40 acres and a mule thing. They didn't know how valuable that land was going to be, but it was because they really wanted to move ahead with this industry canal. And there's a lot of people in the Ninth Ward that didn't want to, that's all they had. They didn't want to give up their land or their house or whatever because that land was gifted. So what, you know, what ended up happening was basically there's, you know, it's not like, it wasn't really a conspiracy, but they don't want, they really wanted to redevelop that area anyway. So they saw that as an opportunity to do that. So they're like, well, all the housing's done, all the things destroyed, we're not going to rebuild it. We're just going to, you know, delay payouts, give you some payouts to do other housing, but not go back and rebuild what you had.
Yes. Yeah, classic disaster capitalism.
And then it worked in tandem with what was going on in other places in the Shock Doctrine and all that kind of stuff. So
and Jeffrey was down there talking to people.
He was talking to people
impacting.
And figuring it out. And there was this guy named Malik who created Common Ground and became part of HUD during the Obama administration. But he was an ex-Black Panther, and he was he basically got everybody that was disgruntled in all the aid organizations that weren't doing enough or weren't doing anything because of either systematic or just even overt racism. It was amazing. It would be where you would think the disaster zone where you should be with all the people is where the aid organization. No. They want to be over here in Gretna. They don't want to be down in the Ninth Ward and help anybody. So, you know, it was a test case scenario to show, like, here's how screwed up, you have this idea of prosperity and access to, you know, everything that you can in America. And then you just, in this one fell swoop, you could see basically it is just survival of the fittest. And there's so many policies and other things that are driving, not helping out your neighbor.
What follows is an on-site interview with local teacher Don Lindsay, who guided Jeffrey through the rubble of the devastated Lower Ninth Ward and
provided haunting and gruesome descriptions of the mess, along with the locals' outraged reaction to the political opportunism and machinations rising in the storm's wake, and the racism that it revealed. Please be advised that very coarse language is used in this segment. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Really, words cannot describe this. I mean, I don't think nobody in America in modern day time have ever seen anything like this.
This is total disaster.
Yeah, you know, it's not even a word for this. Catastrophe and disaster, that's nice. They need a new, the dictionary, Webster need to come up with some new shit, because this ain't going to get it. I'm keeping it real.
This is not the first time this happened. You see, this happened 40 years ago for Bessie, where they blew up the levees to keep the water from going in certain areas.
Down here,
the exact same area, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Now that's a coincidence again.
I'm about to for Bessie.
That every time that there's a flood or a hurricane, that they blow up. The levee gives in certain areas, but it's always the black area. It's old. The exact same thing happened 40 years ago. I was 11 years old. The exact same area, the levee gave. People that was over here say they hear the explosion before the levee gave. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know too many levees that explode when the water hits. Okay? Normally that sounds like something man-made. You know, we're just tired of it. Just give us what we have so we can move on and get better things. And I don't have to worry about coming back on this area here. If I mean, some people didn't want to come, rebuild a levee. I mean, but to leave it like this and neglect us and leave us hanging like this is wrong, you know.
Okay, so they're trying to tell you you're not going to be moving back into this neighborhood ever.
That would sound like we're not going
to
be leaving.
They're trying to get people out of the city and to leave.
Yeah.
Because this is a...
What happens with them? Like, that's not the end of the story. Those people don't vanish when they leave the city limits. Where are they telling them to go?
They're really not telling you to go nowhere. They're not really making no provisions for you. However, the places that we are staying, those people really don't want us there, and we really don't want to be there. I'm more than sure that most New Orleanians, no matter where they are, I mean, we appreciate, you know, being somewhere where we can take care of ourselves and, you know, it's all right, but I mean, it's no place in the world like New Orleans. Not even in the state of Louisiana. We're not talking about the state of Louisiana. There's nowhere in the world like New Orleans. And New Orleans are diehard
people
who want to be in New Orleans.
For the last 5 years.
Sealand has been trying to buy this area for 5 years.
For the last 5 years. Because they want to make commercial areas different stuff in this area. Because they've approached us on two or three different occasions about selling our property. Okay, this is home for us. Okay, they know this is a great opportunity. That's why they don't want to rebuild, because they know they can get money.
And they
want to give you what, $2,000-$4,000,
and make you happy with that.
And make you happy. I mean, I've been here all my life. I worked all my life to get what I had. You understand? For them to just come in here and say, well, we're not going to rebuild. You can't tell us where to rebuild. I mean, this is our property. I mean, if you're going to give us something and make us sell out, give us something worthwhile where we can be happy when we sell out, not when we sell out and then be disappointed. You understand? All we want is a fair shake. I mean, give us, black and white don't have nothing to do with
something that America has never given the black man.
Give us something that we can be proud of. This was a decision that I made and I can be proud of. I don't want to make no decision right now in this city. 2 or 3 years ago, man, I shouldn't have sold because they forced us. They shouldn't force us to do what we don't want to do. I mean, we want to be here, protect us, build a levee up. This is home. That's all we want.
I guarantee you the tornadoes that happen in Indiana, if any of those white folks want to move back to where they want to move to, they're going to be able to move back there.
And nobody going to say they can't go.
I guarantee you that. I guarantee that.
You give us the funds to
rebuild. With all my heart and life, those people will have funds to rebuild. And if they want to move back to that same spot where that tornado came through, or those tornadoes came
ain't
through,
nobody gonna
they would be
anything.
Able to rebuild and have a, they would be able to pick up with their life and move on. I'm enraged. I'm fed up. I mean, I grew up down here. I don't live in the Lower Ninth Ward anymore. But I grew up down here and lived down here 26 years. And that's why I had to come here, man. And this is heartbreaking. I mean, somebody, CNN and all that shit, they report what they want to report. You know, man, I commend y'all for being here. I really do, because they don't see this shit, man. That's a house right there. Look, that ain't nothing but a pile of debris.
And that's a car parked on a car. Right in front of you.
Go around the corner, you can see a house on top of a house. Right on Rainier Street. Bullshit you not. That's real. It ain't no sugarcoating it, man. Because the more we try to act right and act decent, if you don't let them know you're pissed off and fed up, hey, you still might not get nothing, but at least you're going to know I'm pissed off and fed up. Because, hey, man, people down here begging and trying and crying. And you know how many people died down here in the hurricane? Hey, man, this is the most impoverished area of New Orleans.
There was so many instances of police basically taking over drug rackets or, like, stealing or, like, shooting people that are unarmed, you know, just people walking. There was all these crazy things that are going on, all these stories that Jeffrey was collecting, and he was just like, well...
You had a special talent for that.
This is it, because everybody else was confused. The mass media at the time was confused. Well, how can this happen, you know? And, our mission as community radio was just to basically, let's go right to the people... And people are just on the floor, and we would have reports all the time about this is actually what's happening. Here's somebody that's in charge of this area and this district of people. Here's a doctor. Here's a lawyer. Here's, you know, like, and then they would just come on and talk about, you know, this is what's going on in the Ninth Ward as far as we can tell. This is the lack of government support, lack of military support, and, you know, the scary police.
Yeah.
That are really not giving any support at all and just terrifying everybody. If they went out on curfew.
So we're joined on the line with news director Jeffrey Young live from New Orleans. So the story of New Orleans has kind of dropped off the media radar as of late. So can you give us an update on the current situation down there?
The current situation down here, let's see, people are starting to come back. Since the storm, the crime rate in Houston is was up 70%, and now those folks is making their way back into the city. So last couple of weeks has been somewhat of a shooting gallery. I think there was 10 killings last weekend alone. So they've called in the army and the National Guard, and they're going to help the police actually police. Although the National Guard and the army are being deployed in the kind of calmer areas, and they're leaving the police to shoot it out with the gangsters. The problem with that, as the Times-Picayune had a story today, is that they arrested some sheriff's deputy for running drugs. For folks in the same neighborhood, that's kind of been the flashpoint for the crime, the mid-city area. So that's the situation with life in the city. Life in the city is pretty interesting, but people are trying to come back sort of where they can, basically.
There's an important deadline coming up on August 29th. What's that all about?
You still there?
Yeah.
August 29th is the deadline that has been given. It's the one-year anniversary of the hurricane, and of Hurricane Katrina, and it's the date that's been given as the deadline for everybody to have their houses gutted, or they will have a lien placed on them by the city. Problem being is that the people in the... badly flooded neighborhoods, many of them haven't even got back yet, let alone had a chance to see their house, let alone have time to gut it. And on top of that, they tend to be the poor neighborhoods, so those aren't people who can afford to have their house gutted, which will probably lead to an awful lot of real estate repossessions by the city.
So why isn't the city extending that deadline if the residents aren't equipped to deal with the situation?
Well, the residents that are here cannot have their voice heard, so that's a big part of why it's not being done. It's really unclear to tell, and I think maybe as the time gets closer and there's 5,000 homeowners who are at risk of moving their losing their house, they may be able to exert enough pressure to actually improve the situation at least a little bit.
Have the folks of New Orleans kind of felt abandoned by the American media?
I'm really not sure. There hasn't been really a lot of talk about it. They were kind of just left right from the get-go. So I'd say probably a larger scale feeling abandoned is going on. Really, the governments are doing next to nothing down here that's actually on the ground and helping people. Like, there's a couple infrastructure projects and stuff like that going on, but I don't think that any of it really is having kind of a community level impact sort of thing. It's really just community groups and errant civilians that have been able to have any sort of impact on quality of life at all.
In January of 2010, a magnitude 7 earthquake struck the already devastated island nation of Haiti. Regular CKUW listeners were already aware of the role of the international community, including Canada, in undermining elected President Aristide in order to advance the interests of the exploitive corporate interests within and beyond the country. Jeffrey Young made his way down to Haiti and obtained an on-the-ground understanding of the destruction as it intersected with these wider geopolitical realities. Jeffrey Young provided live reports for CKUW for about 2 weeks in February. Here is his final report from his first trip there on February 19th, 2010.
Today's news break was brought to you by Radio Free World. Radio Free World is CKUW's look at what's going on beyond the perimeter highway.
And I want to describe to you just how the Yanks go around.
Mm-hmm.
They're in Hummers, three Hummers long in a line, and four or five of them in a Hummer. You can see the guns. Guns are really useful in helping rebuild after an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
Like, thank you for bringing guns and not shovels. It's just been so helpful. They don't look at the people directly in the face. They don't talk. They're never on the street. They seem to think it's dangerous. And I have no reason why they might have that impression, because we walk around in the dark here, which is not something you do in Mexico, for example. And sure as hell ain't something you do in most of Peru. It's very safe here, especially if you have a local with you. The people are all entirely hospitable. We have seen two machetes since we got here. One was used for sugar cane and one was used for fruit. We have only seen two machetes. We have only seen guns in the hand of security people at banks and American soldiers. There has been no violence. We have not been harassed. We have not been asked for money. Every single engagement we've had, except for one yesterday on a bus, has been good-natured. I had to get shitty with one guy and be like, oh, clearly Haitians are not trustworthy, just because he was trying to be a dick and he wasn't going to be led away with it. The people are amazing. There's no comparing the actuality to what these people see on the media. I'm really curious as to how the media came up with this crap, because from being here, like, you know, you think they would have to see at least one small sign of the things they show, but I don't know where exactly they found that. Maybe the Pope has too much influence over it or something like that, because it's got nothing to do. I'm eating coconut, by the way, at the same time.
Okay.
It's got nothing to do with how the things really are. There's a serious situation unfolding that we should not be involving ourselves with for safety reasons, but we are going to just in case. There is a tent city with 12,000 people living in it, and they have 8 days to leave. They have nowhere to go. In 8 days, the mayor of Delmas says that he's going to come with guns and bulldozers, and he's going to clear all these people out. There's 12,000 people. The people are like, fine, we want to leave. We don't want to live in a tent city forever, but we need a viable place to go. And they're just not offering this viable place to go, and they're waiting to be kicked out. I don't know, as far as the listeners, what they can do about that, but I would suggest that if you don't like what you hear, this is the Cité de Camp Saint-Louis is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage any listeners that want to give the Governor General's call in office, I haven't been talking much English lately, give the Governor General's office a call, and say they are fully aware of the situation with the Camp Saint-Louis in Port-au-Prince or in Delmas, and that it's just if these 12,000 people get kicked out, they've got a new problem on their hands, let alone the civil unrest that's going to result. The people here, like you just heard, soft-spoken, nice, friendly, soft guy wording it, all right? But let me explain this, in my words. If these people get kicked out like that, shit is going to hit the fan. These people are entirely, these people are entirely fed up of their government and how they have been suffering at the hands of their government, how they have lost everything repeatedly at the hands of their government. And when these 12,000 people get kicked out, it's going to be a very disgusting situation, and probably in many different ways. It's absolutely insane, whatever the logic is behind it. It's worse than the logic saying that tents are a barrier to... That tents are a barrier to economic development, whatever in the hell that's supposed to mean. Also, the situation in Delmas is serious. We met with community leaders there. We can't name them. We can't detail them because their lives have been threatened. And all they're doing is they're just normal people that have kind of taken this position in the community to be speaking for the 12,000 people living there.
Jeffrey made multiple valuable connections during his travels and through his extensive investigations. One of these notable individuals was Pine Rose Dominique, a fifth-generation voodoo priestess and ordained minister of voodoo based in New Jersey. During a visit to Winnipeg, Pine Rose joined Jeffrey in the CKUW studio to talk to listeners about the conditions facing the Haitian people after the earthquake, the role played by voodoo in Haiti, and the role of the diaspora in rebuilding Haiti, among other topics. Here's an excerpt of that conversation, which aired on the program Radio Free World in early 2011.
Yeah, he's God. He's not a religious leader.
No.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk. Started Haiti side. It's even been in some of the media otherwhere. What word can I use legally on the radio here? some asshat in the West, in I think it was Edmonton or Calgary, published an op-ed saying that the reason Haiti is so far behind in development compared to the Dominican Republic was because there's voodoo in Haiti.
Oh, really?
He actually said that, completely missing all the Dominican voodoo.
Okay.
Blaming voodoo for the lack of...
So he forgot about Santeria.
He forgot about Santeria, okay. Yeah. And United States. He forgot about New Orleans, too. Like, he forgot about a lot of voodoo in making this. And as well, both on and off island, there's a lot of talk after the earthquake about you being responsible for the earthquake.
Yes, I know.
Pine Rose having brought on the earthquake and all this sort of crap.
Me and my Loise.
What do you make of that?
Well, I just shake my head when I read things like this. So Pat Robinson from the United States, who says, you know, Haiti made a pact with the devil.
There's a lot of that sort of thing around this town.
You know,
some might even be listening, some frightened Christians.
Unfortunately, I have to disagree with them because if I'm going to make a pact with the devil, I would not have Haiti. I would have skyscrapers, and I would have money, and I would have power, at least for a time, and then I would give my soul up after death.
Yeah.
But why would I suffer for my life just to go Haiti. Back and give my soul up to the devil again after the whole suffering?
On the face of it,
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with not miseducation, uneducated people. I think it has to do with fear.
Yeah.
And a lot of Christian churches or people, I'm not going to attack one religion.
Yeah.
But people are afraid of people who don't look like them, who don't act like them, because you can't control someone who's not like you.
Yeah.
You cannot control. You cannot come into my house and say, Penrose, I don't want you to dress this way. I don't want you to do this because I don't have to bow down to your God. My God looks just like me.
Yeah.
My God sounds just like me. My God lives inside of me. And when my God wants to manifest, my God enters my body and does what I... You know, I ask of them, because you don't serve anything that doesn't serve you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the fear they don't understand. And, and Haitians, because of their voodoo, they've always been very fierce, very egoistic, very, very, you know, strong-minded people. Mm-hmm. And it's all because they know Papa Ogu will be there and they know Dambala is there. So... Enable to for you to control someone with such strong will is to tell them you're a devil worship.
Yeah.
You're doing this wrong.
Yeah.
But who's to say what's wrong and what's right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say what's wrong and what's right?
Scott Price hosted Radio Free World on several occasions and would succeed Jeffrey as CKUW's resident international news reporter when he hosted the show Warning Shots.
When I first came here, not knowing what to expect, just sort of like really enthusiastic and really wide-eyed, and then hearing some of the reporting that would happen on People of Interest and then on what was then called Radio Free World with the news director did, Jeffrey Young, hearing some of that reporting and hearing what could be done and what people were doing was really, really impressive and kind of blew my mind. Like, a lot of the coverage of the earthquake in Haiti and the aftermath was really amazing to me. And what was amazing to me about it was that here's a place that's like, you know, really bare bones, not that much resources, your volunteer time, but look what can be actually be accomplished. And those kind of stories that came from the through Jeffrey Young and the Haiti stuff was like really amazing stories and like ahead of a lot of what, you know, it was later reported and there was some good investigative journalism on this, but CKW was very early calling a lot of criticism about how development money was being spent or not spent, right? How little of it was going to housing or how little of it was going to the actual Haitian people and how that dynamic worked with quote unquote, you know, international development money. That was an early thing with CKW. I mean, later on there was really great reporting, but this was almost immediately after the earthquake. There was already those questions being raised about this, right? So in a lot of ways, CKW's way, in a lot of ways, been kind of ahead of the curve, I think, for such a little station, way ahead of the curve on a lot of things.
If you're talking about a model for development, proper development, not what we're seeing now, what would that look like? How would this go about being created?
Well, I'm not really entirely sure. I spent a lot of my life thinking about this over my work in Haiti, and is this how to do it? Is what we're doing correct? Is it going to be more successful than these other models? Really, I'm going to repeat what a lot of Haitians say. I think it would be better if the white workers just stayed away completely. And if your project is not Haitian-driven and is not Haitian-determined, then maybe it shouldn't be taking part in the first place. And what is needed is a regime of Western country, of Northern countries in this case, taking hands off, just basic hands off Haiti. Let Haiti develop in a natural Haitian-determined, Haitian-driven sort of way, and chances are that development will be more sustainable than the kind of colonial undertone development that's taken place there in the past. I think if you leave them alone, they'll do just fine, thank you very much. I recently got to spend a few weeks in Iquitos, Peru, which is in the middle of the Amazon. It's the world's largest city with no road access, and there you can see local populations determining their own development in a way that wasn't possible in Haiti. And what you see is a lot more schools, a lot more infrastructure. You have a situation where despite making an average of $1 to $3 a day, everybody generally eats and everybody is generally sheltered because their development has come at their own hands as Amazonians instead of kind of being foisted on them by outside interests and stuff like that. Now, granted, the church and whatnot are there, but as agents of development, it's the people that have adapted to that particular environment to be able to make it sustain the lives of the 500,000 people that live around there. And in terms of Haiti, you know, that's a very small country. There's only 9 million people, and is rather resource rich for the 9 million people there. They could live off the tourism built along the beaches because the whole country is pretty much beach, for example. So just returning as much control as possible and putting it in Haitian hands and kind of supporting, educating those Haitian hands so that they can best meet the outcomes that are most favorable to their communities.
Right. I mean, it's funny, too, because, I mean, that seems to make the most sense when you lay it out like that. Yet, I mean, it people would there'd be a lot of folk who would say, well, you're crazy. That would never work. Right.
Well, what is actually preposterous is a bunch of Northern Canadians. I'm not going to just continue attacking Mennonites, but a bunch of Northern Canadian intellectuals and researchers and studiers and quote-unquote development workers thinking that they know best what is best for an island in the Caribbean several thousand miles away with a cultural backing in African animism and French colonialism. So really having no common experience to many of the development workers that go there whatsoever. And when those workers show up, what they tend to do is impose culture, not sort of... what would you say? I'm going to use the word bow, but it's not really the correct word. Rather than kind of bowing to the predominant culture and letting it determine the development outcomes.
Haiti, which wasn't you know, like we report on the story, but it was also kind of very depressing as well. Just kind of learned that, you know, it's very difficult to do almost anything. With, you know, with how much, too many cooks, too much corruption, and just how like little and manageable.
It really opens your eyes, like being there and talking to these, you know, those primary sources.
It's kind of a nightmare scenario where you just got these, you know, this horrible paternalistic kind of aid agencies that just meddle with the agency of... Yeah. Of the Haitian people, so their political aims are not their political aims, and all of a sudden it's just a mishmash of I can't help you if you don't help me, and vice versa, and you know, Haitians know that. I'm like, well, no, just give us money, and we'll let you help, because I don't know what you're going to do, you know. So anyway, so that was an eye opener as well, but it also that was kind of the turn. Where I stepped back and Jeffrey stepped back from doing a lot more international reporting, and you know,
I'm wondering if like over the course of the reporting that you've done there, what you know, some notable learning experiences, lessons that came out of that maybe may have added to your perspective on journalism and on community.
Only call in live from something that is stressful after you have reached the age of 40. Don't do that when you're a kid. You're going to embarrass yourself, and nobody ever taped that, and that's good because it was embarrassing. Oh. The first actual from Bay St. Louis, it was with Kent, and it was it's gone now, so nobody will ever hear it, and that's good.
Okay.
So there's a bunch of.
Well,
I don't know. I don't know. And actually, looking back at the, let's start with the first one first. I'm not really sure. What I think about America currently, I'm sort of taking a break and trying not to engage and. Ignoring the news unless it's something particularly awesome, like we took the airports. You know, I'll read that just because it makes me grin. But I don't think it's just not where I'm at right now to be over involved with that, because you know things are weird in the States. It's just Alaska, and I had to go there. Through there quite often up to a year ago, places like Charlotte and God knows whatever airport, where you don't see the people that live there, but you see the people from around there and that are moving through there, and it got especially further down south, it got kind of weird. One of the effects of Donald Trump is kind of like he's taken the psychotic fringe, and I don't mean like the freaks and acid people, I mean like the psychotic fringe. And he's kind of like validated them and empowered them to have like, pride in things they shouldn't. And
it's just been a really creepy kind of vibe. The sort of this new Jeffrey Epstein thing is not very surprising, because he's kind of brought them out of the woodwork. And to take this back to where we started the conversation, all done in a context of what looks to be a considerable level of impunity, and just not being in line with how people should basically have been raised, and so I'm just kind of taking a break from more active involvement in those aspects of the world.
Yeah, you put a book together on Hurricane Katrina on your reporting.
Yes.
And I think that was for the 10th anniversary. Is there a hint you could give us, maybe updating us on some of that reporting that you did from you back then? I mean, a non-spoiler hint that give
us... It's been a whole bunch of kind of like making a record, I think. It's been a whole bunch of like, oh, this is very good, but this part. Oh, this is very good, but this part. And everybody has their own kind of... own preconceptions as to what happened in the story I'm telling, and they always expect it to match those to a T. So it's a bit the book publishing part of it is dicey,
yeah,
to say the best. I was back there a few years ago, and it was much more. Well, I don't know, because I had never been there previously, but it seemed pretty a little more harmonious and mixed than it had previously. That might have been due to maybe perhaps an increase in black tourism, or maybe because people learned. Neither one would surprise me. So I think New Orleans had done well for itself. Currently, it's raining there, and there is a hurricane forming kind of around them. I hear there's a lot of water around. I see that too. I'm on the Facebook. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's see what happens with this one.
You hooked up with Malik again?
I've been in contact with him periodically. He ran as a Green Party candidate a while back.
Interesting.
And that's you know basically about it. Everybody's well. Nobody has died that I know of.
Yeah, it's pretty
of the characters from the from my trip and from that time in the radio broadcasting.
Yeah, cool.
And in terms of the Haiti, everybody is somewhere else, and good for them.
Yeah,
because somewhere else is no longer in Haiti, and good for them, because you do that when you get the chance. You know what I mean? It's just something you kind of got to do if you have the opportunity. Unfortunate that is. So they're in Miami and New York and Montreal now.
Yeah.
Except for a couple.
I remember, I believe it was one of your Haiti trips. You took a couple of personnel from the university. I think CKUW went down with you. And I mean, I believe them to be kind of competent and people, but they were still quite green and rookies.
And me too. Haiti won. For the time being, like, it's definitely up a couple points. It was a lot longer and more difficult and harder. Support wasn't exactly as we were told it was going to be, which I now know is kind of part and parcel of doing things like that. It was as you can imagine, it was a lot tougher context, because the starting point compared to New Orleans was just so completely different. And yeah, I think that was the biggest effect of that. Because of the South American living, the Haiti was more useful, because after that, it's scared as easily. Like, it's a little bit harder to catch your attention, my attention, than it was before. And that helped me greatly in South America, get out of situations when I needed to.
Yeah.
It definitely was a big part of my life's learning trip, and I would recommend to anybody to get out and spend some time in other cultures with people that live actually really meaningfully different. And that doesn't mean backpacker around Europe for the summer. Those people don't live differently. But, like, you know, get out there and put yourself in a position where things could go south on you if you don't have yourself in check. And you know, you learn a lot quickly when completely surrounded by different.
Much like your training methods at CKUW when you're just starting out.
Yeah, very much like that. You don't really have a lot of choice. Yeah, and also a lot of definitely eye-catching moments that you could put your finger on. Community stations generally are a place where people that do stuff like this end up. I know that Ethan Osland, a longtime CKUW volunteer, just taken a trip or two that got his attention more than a beach in Florida would have. And Dave Kattenberg, God knows where he is at any given time and who he's being held in question by. Now that the corporate media has no more interest in interesting things ever, it's like the community radio is a last outlet for people like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where the corporate media...
The kind of international class, the people whose kind of nationality gets diluted over years of being other places Those people, you know, like anybody, they're equipped to offer a certain experience and outlook to their community.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it sounds like where corporate media is averse to wander, we community radio stations embrace these uncomfortable situations. Jeffrey Young, I really appreciate having you back on our station's airwaves, and thank you for your long contributions to our joint collective endeavor.
And all right. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to part 3 of CKUW's special look at 20 years of spoken word programming on FM. This week we've been examining the unique contributions from former CKUW news director and sometime correspondent Jeffrey Young. Listeners can find some of his work, including those featured on today's show, by visiting radioforall.net, clicking on the contributor link, and searching under CKUW News. Please feel free to send your feedback. You can email Program Director Sam Doucette at programming@ckuw.ca or phone the station at 204-786-9782. Next week, we'll feature some clips and new interviews with some of the cast of CKUW's 2008-2009 radio drama, At the Monarch's Convenience. We hope you'll tune in then. For CKUW, this has been host Michael Welch. Talk to you again in 7 days.
God knows I love the way that people decorate their homes. I love the ovens and the casseroles they bake. I love the things that people make.